It's not a nice, clean calendar year of which I write, but the 12 months spanning June 2019 to June 2020, beginning the day I started at First Provident. I start with this day not because my analyst position at an investment bank was a big deal, it was, but because it was the day I first laid eyes on David. I try many times throughout this telling to explain the effect he had on me. It was as if he'd cast a spell, or more accurately, as if he found me at the precise moment I was longing for a spell to be cast. Meeting him was all wrapped up in the thrill of the new job, the magic of New York, everything charged con tanta ilusión, with so much hope. I'd moved into a studio apartment with Ray days after our college graduation, and when I wasn't exploring the East Village, I was putting together the right outfit or practicing my commute, the best strategy for the morning rush, from riding the subway to savoring spicy mustard atop a salted pretzel. I thrived on the pulse of the city, which pounded in my inner ear like the heartbeat of the universe. It's possible David and I crossed paths by chance, just as I was inhabiting every movie and song about New York's propulsive quality, convinced my destiny waited around the next corner. But when our lives did collide, it was as if I recognized him, or recognized something about him, that intangible something at the core of every fantasy, with the lights on Broadway as a backdrop or the snow falling in Central Park. And in every version of that dream, I was on my way to becoming glamorous and strong, a confident woman who thought nothing of darting into midtown traffic to flag down a yellow cab. No taxis that first morning, however. I was just as happy to cram onto the F train at 2nd Avenue, transferring at Lafayette to the 6 uptown. I finally felt relevant, an honest-to-God member of the adult population, having checked my bag for phone, keys, wallet, before hurrying out the door to make things happen. Disembarking at 51st and Lex, I paused on the stuffy underground platform to freshen my lipstick, using the same tube Ray once dubbed backstage as my red-hot shot of confidence. I ascended the stairs and caught sight of a corner bodega and a man dousing white plastic tubs full of tulips with a hose. It was another wonder of the city that freshly cut flowers showed up each morning on street corners of wet concrete, fresh, damp, and ready for the stampede. My fellow pedestrians were glued to their phones or balancing trays of coffee as they waited for the walk signal. But I gripped the shoulder straps of my new leather satchel, gaped at the towering skyscrapers, letting the current of humanity carry me along until it deposited me in front of First Provident headquarters on 52nd between Park and Madison. "I barely recognized you," I whispered to Ethan. He sat at the end of a long folding table wearing a dark blue suit with hair cut much shorter than the lax bro look he'd fashioned at Lyle College. "My new look," he said, running his fingers across his scalp. "Coffee any good?" We'd been mere acquaintances in college. He was one of those jocks who wore the name of a fancy boarding school across his chest. Born and bred in New England, Ethan was a lacrosse star at our small college, whereas I came from the country's southernmost tip and was part of the theater crowd.
"It'll do," he said.
First Provident prided itself on its two-month boot camp, claiming its methods were proven to convert even the most humanities-centric liberal arts major into an investment banker, or, at a minimum, into somebody who could crunch it out for 2 years. Despite the sour energy of the 15th floor, it provided a familiar classroom-like setting, an intermediate step before being assigned to one of the floors above. I took a moment to survey the room. It couldn't have been more different than the rich environment where I'd been interviewed and welcomed back on cell day. The training floor had no well-appointed offices, no panoramic views of the skyline, no windows at all, for that matter. It was 100% utilitarian, with a drop panel ceiling, beige soundproof walls, and industrial carpeting punctured at regular intervals with electrical outlets. I'd later learn it had been home to the now defunct sales and trading department, disbanded rather abruptly in 2008 after calamitous proprietary trade. I won't lie, I was pretty nervous about my lack of finance experience.
I'd been reading the Wall Street Journal in my college library all spring, and I'd always been good at math, but I'd only taken one econ class at Lyle. I was a double major in theater and psych and found comfort in my advisor's postulation that, in the end, success comes down to acting and psychology. "Go ahead, apply," she had shrugged. "Why not? It's the only white shoe firm that recruits on campus." I had no idea what that meant, but it sounded rebellious, like trying on the glass slipper an evil stepmother was keeping from me. I also liked the idea of detouring off my expected path and doing something more cerebral, because for as long as I could remember, adults had been telling me, "With that height and that face, you'll be famous." Besides, once you heard about the serious coin people banked in those two-year analyst programs, it made the idea of scraping by on tips between auditions seem sort of silly. I filled a mug with coffee and sat down, grateful for the respite from my heels. I didn't mind if Ethan saw me wince because we were in this together. Outliers, hired due to the bank's chairman, Theodore Johnstone, being an alumnus of Lyle College. He'd mandated two graduating seniors from his alma mater be extended offers each year along with recruited talent from the nation's top campuses. He'd likened Lyle to small top-tier New England colleges, the Amherst and Williams of the world, which Ethan and I both knew it wasn't. Chairman Johnstone was either out of touch or chose to ignore Lyle's evolving reputation as a safety school for rich kids with a student body of 2,200 tucked away in a frozen pocket of upstate New York where partying and bad behavior were overlooked byproducts of extreme isolation. We would be dubbed Lyle Hires by the other analysts, but Ethan would never feel it as much as me. He was a white male with a degree in economics, whereas I was not white, had a name people had a hard time pronouncing, and hadn't yet deciphered the instructions for my HP-12C. I tucked my hands under my thighs and reminded myself that this firm had hired me. I inhaled deeply and turned my attention to the woman at the front of the room, wondering if anybody else was pinching themselves. Her name was Helen, and she said she headed up HR. Standing at the podium, she cleared her throat. "Now, the pace of the summer will be fast. The equivalent of a 4-year finance degree condensed into 10 weeks. We don't have a minute to spare." Her underlings made their way around the room, issuing First Provident email accounts, cell phones, laptops, credit cards, and paperwork for our 401ks. When a young woman got around to the table I shared with Ethan, I said, "Hey, I'm Betts Reese." The woman scanned her clipboard, her harried expression turning into a frown. "Oh dear, this must be a mistake," she said. "No, you've got it right," I said, pointing to my name on her list. "I'm Betsabe, but people call me Bets for short." My first grade teacher had even gone so far as to suggest, "We'll call you Betsy." So, in the same way I dutifully dressed in an itchy plaid jumper, I wore that nickname for a few weeks too. That is, until my mother found out. She marched into the classroom, dragging me by the wrist, and corrected the teacher. "Her name is Betsabe Isabella Ruiz." And even though Betsabe rolled off the tongues of our clan in Miami like music, it was not a name you'd often hear. As in, I'd never met another Betsabe. The literal meaning was daughter of a promise, or, in my case, a broken one.